Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and today I get a chance to talk with Dan Griffin. Hi, Dan.
Well, hi, Dennis. How are you?
Oh, I'm very well, thank you. Listen, Dan, I'm really interested in this subject today because you have done a lot of work in helping. You know, we have talked about how we've had women's empowerment, and we have an opportunity to bring half the sky into the men's realm. At the same time, we're looking at what is going on with men, what has happened with men, what can we do, how can we grow, where can we go. So what was your impelling to get into to help us as men to be able to recover and to grow our voices? Can you talk a little bit about that? I know it's a huge subject, but dive in there and let's see where we go.
Oh, absolutely. So given that we have a little bit of time, I'll tell you the longer story.
I like that.
What I can tell you is that there were several factors that got me to begin looking in this direction, but all of those factors point to the fact that this is something that really chose me much more than I chose it. And it started when I was 7th grade, 8th grade, and I had one of those experiences that I don't think a lot of men have, but those of us who have had it, it's been quite profound. And that is that not only did I not grow, I didn't hit puberty, and at 15 and a half, I had to be medically treated to go through puberty. And so what was very interesting for me was here I am, 15 and a half, and coming from a violent alcoholic home and already feeling a great sense of powerlessness. And I'm 5 foot tall. I'm 95 pounds. I'm a sophomore in high school. I went from being one of the most popular kids in elementary school, and then to being the kid that was being put in the trash can, being the kid that was made fun of, being the kid that not only did the other kids make fun of, but the teachers made fun of.
Yeah.
And I was smart enough, insightful enough, and probably hypersensitive enough that it was clear that that was connected to masculinity, that I wasn't a man, I wasn't growing, I wasn't big, I didn't feel like I could defend myself. And so that really started the process of me standing outside of masculinity and questioning it. Because if I didn't question it, then it would mean that there was absolutely 100% something fundamentally wrong with me.
Right.
And so as a result, that began this inner conversation that continued. I did hit puberty. I did grow. You wouldn't look at me and notice that or see that at this point in my life. I'm 42. But different points converged together. And by the time I was a senior in college, I was focused on sociology of gender, and I also began my own recovery journey.
That's fascinating because, Dan, too, do you remember, since you were much older than I was by like about 3 years, when testosterone hit your brain?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm a trained sociologist, and I am far from the nature versus nurture. When it comes to the nature versus nurture argument, I'm pretty far from the nature piece. And so part of how I hear that question is, you know, the impact of testosterone, did that have the impact that it does on other young men, or how much did I notice it? You know, I don't know. I don't look back and see necessarily how much it was affecting me, but it's also because there were confounding factors. Because at the same
Sure.
time that I started those testosterone shots, I was starting to drink and I was starting to smoke pot. And
of course.
So there was that. Then I was also in high school, you know, and so I was around a kind of whole crowd of young men who were all trying to assert themselves and establish themselves. And regardless of puberty or any of that aspect, I was still a part of that,
sure.
that group. So, you know, very quickly, my grief and shame and powerlessness turned into anger and rage. And that became kind of the dominant experience for me. Now, when I think back of that, do I think that that was related to the infusion of testosterone? Not really. I don't personally.
Yeah.
Could it be connected to it? Maybe.
Sure.
But maybe it's probably an admixture of factors, right? So the infusion of testosterone, the chaos of the alcoholic home, the adolescence in and of itself and the way my brain was developing as well, and, you know, beginning to use alcohol and other drugs myself.
Sure. So can you point to a route out of this? Because this is a spiral that many of us never recover from.
Yeah, so it depends on which spiral which spiral.
Yeah, exactly. And I know, I mean, this is the thing about it, Dan. I realize that without spending days with us talking, I cannot ask you a salient enough question that can really dig down in this. Please understand, I don't know the answers. All I know is my experience. And I really, your fascination with sociology and to look at it, were you always able to step like one step aside and go, wow, that's really interesting to see how all of this is going on at the same time, even though you're in it too?
Yeah, so, you know, it's funny that you asked that. So when I asked about the spiral, it's like, you know, what do we mean? Do we mean the spiral that men have as they attempt to force themselves into the Procrustean bed of masculinity? You know, or is it the spiral that one experiences when they start
yeah.
using alcohol and other drugs?
Yeah,
or
all of
is it
yeah.
the spiral of the two of those together? And the answer is yes, right?
Yeah.
The answer is all of the above. You like that analogy, or you like my
love it. Thank you. This is what I was hoping for in this conversation. Please help me. Help me talk about this with some.
Unfortunately, probably a lot of people are turning to their dictionary right now to look up Procrustean, but it really does fit, right? Because, I mean, that is how men fit themselves into masculinity, and literally by
yeah.
cutting off parts of themselves
sure.
to do so.
Nice.
And, you know, it's interesting that you say that. When I was in it, could I step back and see it? Well, remember, because of the testosterone shots, I kind of had to.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm surrounded by these guys that are growing, and you know, all of a sudden these guys, by the time I was 15 and a half, the little 13-and-a-half-year-old kids that I used to push around, that I used to definitely be alpha over, I started now cowering in fear from.
Wow.
So I had to navigate that with some consciousness of being outside in order to survive. You know, quite
okay.
honestly, you know, in order to
sure.
not destroy myself or others, and it still approached that point. And I use this metaphor, it's really a parable of, I imagine you've even heard it before, but I talk about the water, and it refers to these two fish that are hanging out at the bottom of the ocean, and another fish swims up and says, "Hey guys, how's the water?" and swims off. And the two fish look at each other and they say, "What the hell is water?" And, you know, that is how so
right.
many of us experience reality, but particularly how we experience gender. we are so immersed in it, we don't realize that we're putting it on every morning, that we are constantly navigating our sense of gender on a regular, daily, hourly basis. We don't see it because we think it's who we are. And I had the gift, ultimately I see it as a gift, of being able to step outside of that and see it. And even more interestingly, is it was an internal conversation that only I was having with myself, and so it was intermixed with shame and rage and loneliness and despair.
So
when I got into college, and I get into sociology, and I get into sociology of gender, and I take the sociology of women class, and I start talking to my professor, and I say, well, we're talking about women. Was anybody looking at men? And she said, well, I think so. And I started doing some research, and I did my senior thesis on this. And then I realized I'm not the only one who struggled with being a man, and I'm not the only one who's thinking about this. And so, Dennis, and then this is the most profound thing. This is maybe the most profound part of the experience, because it hit me personally like a ton of bricks, although I don't know that it necessarily has the same effect on other men. But being a man in recovery, and in particular 12-step recovery, I got sober very young. So I got sober at the age of 21. I had literally just graduated from college. By somehow I was able to make it out in 4 years. I don't know if that says anything about the institution I went to or my intelligence or both or something. but I graduated in 4 years, and I just had a complete, you know, my senior year was full of attempting to drink, not drink, smoke pot, not smoke pot, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
So I go to my first meeting. I walk through the door, and a man tries to hug me. And I immediately think, okay, what's going on here? And then, you know, that got my attention. But
sure.
Then, and I'll never forget this, there was a man there, and I don't even remember his name, but he had a hat that said, honk if you love tits. And he had a big white shirt that was stained, like he had been wiping his greasy hands on it for like the last 3 months or something. And I looked at this guy, and here I am, this spoiled little preppy kid from suburban Maryland, and I'm in a small town in Virginia, and I look at this guy and I think, oh, God, where have I ended up? The lost valley of losers, you know, everything I feared about 12-step community is standing in front of me, and I'm judging this guy. And 30 minutes later, this guy, who I perceive to be the epitome of traditional, even toxic masculinity, is talking to the whole room and talking about his fear and talking about how he's afraid he's going to lose his marriage and how he is at this place again of desperation. And it's when it occurred to me, oh, my God, these men are communicating in a way that's different from how men communicate. And that was the key awareness. And from that moment on, I paid attention. I paid very, very close attention to my own experience as I grew in my recovery, to my own experience as I grew to become somewhat of an adult, and in my own experience as I watched and grew closer to these men in that community. And I was like, is anybody else noticing this? You guys? Like, we're talking about our relationships in a way that guys aren't supposed to talk about their relationships. We're talking about our feelings. Anybody else freaking out about this?
Not
the answer, because the answer was predicated, what was the guide of my master's research, and the question was the focus of my master's research and my first book, A Man's Way Through the 12 Steps. The one question I asked 60 men that I interviewed, how have your ideas of being a man changed since getting into recovery? And the number one answer from the men was, they haven't. And so that convinced me, that confirmed for me, that what I was seeing, other people weren't seeing. And when I did my master's, even though I wrote my master's and it, you know, it felt good, I didn't have the confidence. I didn't have my own maybe mature insight to be able to say, because other men don't see it, doesn't mean it's not real. And I took it more as a continued meaning of the fact that I wasn't a man, that I didn't fit into the men's club, that I'm just being extra sensitive because I'm not a man, you know. And I had that trauma from when I was with the puberty and the testosterone. I had that trauma stuck in my brain, and it was constantly taunting me in the background every interaction I had. So I figured, that's what's going on here, that this isn't a larger cultural piece. This isn't a larger community piece. This isn't a larger piece about our sense of being men. This is just me and more of my own inability to truly be
Absolutely.
A man.
Absolutely. So what kept you going on and kept you exploring? Because I've studied quantum physics and I've studied spirituality and science and the history of as people try to make breakthroughs, and the space where you are is a space that the pioneers have to get to when they feel so alone, and people are saying, no, your research is not work, you're out there, it's not going to work, but they keep going.
Well,
what was it? Can you talk about that? I mean, that tenacity, that willingness to go, okay, well, I'm gonna give it one more shot. Damn it.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, and you're one of the few people I've spoken to. Maybe I'm getting better at communicating it, but you're one of the few hosts that I've spoken to who really seems to get how incredibly hard it was for me to stay with that.
Jesus.
I don't know. I mean, I'd love to say it was something special about me, but I don't think that's
I would
true.
Hope
but remember,
not.
I
would hope not. I would hope not that it isn't something special
about
you. Because if it isn't, there's hope for all of us. If it is special about you, then we don't have a we don't have a prayer. But if it isn't, now we're on to something.
Well, and that's the thing, right? So remember at the very beginning of this conversation, I said, this is something that chose me much more than I chose it.
Yes.
And some of us get that double-edged gift of being immersed in some awareness that we really didn't ask for, we really don't want necessarily, but that it really is an awareness that can shift so much more than just our own personal lives. How did I get that? I don't know. How did I know that it really was true, even though, I mean, I can't tell you how many people turned me down as far as books or told me, like, why would we do that? Or everything's focused on men, so why would we even think about that? I mean, the category
right.
of things, of responses that I got. So why did I continue? I continued for a couple of reasons as I think about this. One, because of my spiritual connection and my spiritual thirst, I was always looking for quote-unquote signs to continue.
Yeah.
And I would get them. I would get them. I mean, Dennis, I had every single person, every faculty person where I went to graduate school advising me not to do my master's. And
wow.
I went through two other topics before I ultimately went back to the social construction of masculinity and the culture of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the only reason I went back is because at one of the meetings, a man knew that I was interested in this, and he handed me a book, and the book was called When Society Becomes an Addict by Ann Wilson Chafe. And I read that book, and that book validated what I was thinking, and it was the first time I had heard somebody talk about it even remotely like I had been thinking about it. And in that space, I absolutely knew that was the master's program, that was the master's research I was supposed to do, and it didn't matter what the faculty said. And interestingly enough, and I still remember this vividly, when I first moved out to Kansas for my graduate work, and that was after taking a year off to get sober and just find some recovery, when I moved there, I was only there for about 30 days when my father died from chronic alcoholism at the age of 54. And, you know, that severed a relationship that never existed. You know, and but you know what happened? And it's funny, I really haven't reflected on this until you asked. But what happened was I turned to my father for the first time after he died to be a father. And I would literally walk home at night and I would look up at the stars and I would say, you know, you weren't much of a father while you were alive. Can you throw me a bone? Can you give me some help? And I'll be honest with you, I think it was moments like that and interventions like that and efforts on my part that kept me going enough to maintain some interest in it. But I will also tell you, I was at Hazelden training to be a counselor in 1998. I started writing A Man's Way Through the 12 Steps, and it wasn't called that at first. It was called Recovering Masculinity. And I started writing that book, and you know, I then got some feedback about the book and about, you know, where my thoughts were at with it. And I walked away from it for another, oh boy, I didn't publish the book until 2009, and 2008 is when I really made a decision to do it. So I walked away for almost 10 years from the whole topic.
That's amazing. It's amazing how when we have a calling, we cannot escape it, not through...
Right. I may not be particularly Christian, but I grew up Catholic, and I know, yep. You know, there's some wonderful stories in the Bible, and one of the stories, of course, is about Jonah, and there's a great joke about Jonah and the big whale, and if God says you're going to Nineveh, you're going to Nineveh.
I love it. I don't even know what thousand questions to select among that are occurring to me all at the same time that are jumping right into my queue and they're demanding attention. So let me seek in there and pull up and see what I want.
Let's call this part one.
Yeah, exactly. So Dan, you know, I look back on if I could, from a sociological perspective, and I look back to Bill and Dr. Bob and the very first people that got together in Akron to start Alcoholics Anonymous and begin that process back in the 30s, and you know the long arduous process that went to just to try to get the 12 steps together. What the hell was this? And the fighting that went back and forth, and I look back and it appears to me that that sociologists are going to write about that this was a turning point for humanity. And I don't mean just there, but I'm talking about in the 21st century, the idea of working into a support group structure is what we're seeing. We're seeing teams and pods in businesses. We're seeing that there is an influence that is way beyond what happened right there that started with those two. So could you give me any ideas or your thoughts on that?
Oh, I would love to. I mean, that's really a whole nother conversation. I wrote several papers during my graduate degree about looking at political action as it is interwoven through the 12 steps, looking at deconstruction of society through the 12 steps, looking at postmodern philosophy through the guise of what was happening with the spiritual movement of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps. I mean, these are papers that I don't even know where they are. But I was fascinated by the same question, Dennis, and I was absolutely convinced that this was something amazing. And I don't think you and I are by far the only ones to be thinking along these lines, because once you get into it, it's so apparent that it's a piece that's missing. Now, that being said, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the World Council of Religions, I believe it is who it was, voted the 12-step movement to be the most significant impact on religion and spirituality of the 20th century. Several scholars have studied the organizational aspects of the 12 steps and Alcoholics Anonymous and have called it the closest thing to democracy our world has ever seen. Robin Room is a man who, out of California, wrote about the 12 steps as a key element in political action. I wrote a whole paper called Awareness, Acceptance, Action, and I looked at the isms of racism, sexism, heterosexism as components of alcoholism and addiction, and N. Wilson Chafe's kind of thesis about when society becomes an addict, when you see a society that is acting and behaving like one who is addicted, and what does that mean, and how are those connected? And so, yeah, I put a lot of thought into it, and it's fascinating, and I am absolutely convinced, like you, like I heard you saying,
yep,
there would be no Oprah without the 12-step movement. There'd be no Dr. Phil. There'd be no Phil, what's his name? The guy from Phil Donahue. There'd be no Phil Donahue. There, you know, so many of these things have slowly come about because of the 12-step movement and what it shifted, what it created. I mean, for one, for the first time, you have this collective consciousness that is saying it's God as you understood God, not God as mandated. And then you have this thing where people are sitting around and they're telling their truth in a way that is just foreign to humankind for the most part. And that's one of the things, that's one of the statements I wrote in my latest book, A Man's Way Through Relationships, where isn't it amazing that if you boil it down to its essence, all 12-step meetings are, in many ways, is people sitting around telling their truth.
Yep.
And yet it's that profound? That's amazing.
Isn't it? It is that profound. You know, Dan, I sit there and one of the things that has been so valuable to me here in the 21st century, and I am a generation and a half down from you, so I'm 67 this year. And and when I grew up, it appeared to me to be such a narrow definition. And I remember my great uncle, who was my grandfather figure in my life, and he'd say, "Man, that is mighty much a man." And I looked inside of me and I went, that's nothing like what I am. And how does that work? And if that's what it is, and I couldn't share with anyone the insecurities and fears and what were going on in my life. What I'm so grateful for with television that is as broad as it is, cable and internet, and the kinds of resources that they are, I'm seeing such a broad spectrum of masculinity that I didn't see, so that my bandwidth is so much wider, and just that has been very healing for me, even in addition to everything that I'm saying. Seeing that, and then I look at the kids today that they can actually look, and they can see the kids on Glee, or they can see the other people, and go, "Oh my God, I didn't invent masturbation. It was it's actually something that, you know, it's what we can. It is an amazing healing process that I see that in the amalgam, there's a lot there. Anyway."
No, you know, I mean, honestly, I don't hesitate to get carried away by this because it's powerful stuff. I mean, it really
ain't
is
it
powerful ideas and powerful experiences, and it's so nice. I mean, this is not meant as a well, I'll say it as a compliment to you rather than any
sure.
kind of insult to anyone else. It's wonderful to connect with another deep thinker who really spends their time, you know, looking at this, because obviously holding
Thank
this
you.
Stuff inside of us is, at least it has been for me, has been painful. And
totally.
Even
it
when
completely
I'm with
toxic.
Some of my peers, even when I'm with some of my peers and I want to talk about this, and they
sure.
look at me like I've got three heads, you know, and they're like, dude, I mean, we just wanted to talk about football. What's up with, like, talking about the
yep.
expansion of masculinity of our consciousness because of 21st century media? I mean, it's like, whoa,
yeah.
whoa, you know. And you're absolutely right. I mean, the 60s opened up Pandora's box.
Yeah.
And thankfully so. Right, but in mythology, we know that when Pandora's box got opened, there was as many negative things happened as positive things happened. I mean, the world was unleashed.
Yes.
And in many ways, I would say that's what the Cultural Revolution brought about for us, and there was that shift. I mean, even back in the 70s, there were some of the beginning of consciousness raising for men, but, you know, as a good friend of mine, Dr. Alan Berger, you know, what he says, I think, is really interesting. Women were mobilized by their anger. Men were demobilized by their grief.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that profound?
That is incredible. That brought me to tears. That you saying that, suddenly I connected with something very deep inside of me, Nan.
I get it. I get it. And Alan gets it because he's your peer. So, you know, he grew up in that space of watching this all happen and having to live in a space of women's anger. And I'll be honest with you. I mean, we're in the addictions and mental health field or in our society in general, there's a lot of wonderful, important conversation about women and women's issues and so much that women have experienced. And the dark side of that is I've seen way too many women who are attempting to speak for men and define men's experience and attempting to define men, period, to the extent that you have arrogance and dismissiveness and even something as foolish as a woman who could get away with writing a book called The End of Men.
Yeah. Exactly.
So
exactly.
So there is this. There is this shift, and you know, when I talk about the water, it's like, do people, you know, when I do these trainings or I do talks, I'll say, look, you know, when you leave here today, chances are you're going to think the water is a pond in your community, like just a little pond in your neighborhood. If you stay with this, you're going to see that the water is a river.
Mm-hmm.
And if you stay with this longer, you're going to see that it is a giant lake. And then if you stay with it even longer, you're going to see that it's one of the great lakes. And if you stay with it even longer, you're going to see that it is the Indian Ocean and then the Atlantic Ocean. And then if you really stay with this, you'll see it's the Pacific Ocean. And it is bottomless. And it goes on forever. And it is not good or bad. It's an inquiry into who we want to be, and our most authentic selves can come out of paying attention to that. And we lose so much of who we could be when we let those rigid, what I call the man rules and the woman rules, but when we let the man rules make the decisions for us without us reflecting on it, without us being conscious of it, when we allow that to happen on a daily basis, we lose who we could have been that day. We lose the greatness we could have stepped into in being ourselves rather than deferring or being driven by a force inside of us that is not of us or who we are.
And that is way beyond gender.
Way beyond gender. Way beyond gender. Freud said it. He wasn't thinking about gender when Freud said, we are being lived by forces inside of us.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's and that I you know that's what really is so exciting about what we're doing now. The kinds of conversations that you and I are having now. This is I'm there, there's a physicist named David Bohm,
Oh,
BOHM. He
sure.
did a and he talked about the Bohm dialogues, that this is that space where we create a space. And then we see what dialogues come out of that. The 12-step meetings that I go to, and I love the opportunity to be there, because there's such an egalitarian. If I will open my mind, even a tiny crack, I will hear the most profound wisdom from each and every person who speaks, because it's an extraordinary. I never would have thought that. I mean, I love being smart, and I love impressing people, and I love. And boy, does this change it when I go in there and I just sit there, and I am one. And then suddenly, it all opens up, and I hear the wisdom of the universe coming from each and every person from their experience, and it is humbling and empowering at the same goddamn time.
Yeah, well, I ditto. They say the smarter you are, the harder it is to get the program. And some people, I mean, I consider myself fairly intelligent, and for some reason I got it the first time I walked through the meeting. And I really I cannot credit it to me.
No.
It's grace. And the longer I'm alive, the and stay in my recovery. I mean, I'll have 21 years in 2 weeks. And
Oh,
for
cool.
me, that literally means I have now been sober in recovery half of my life.
Oh, cool. Well,
Half
no,
of my
Dan,
life.
man.
So I've been immersed in this culture, and it's the men of the rooms of recovery that have taught me to be a man. I mean, that have shown me how to be a healthy man. One of the concepts I've developed is I talk about a continuum of masculinity, and it's really not even a linear continuum. It's more of a three-dimensional piece. But I talk about toxic masculinity. I talk about traditional masculinity. I talk about the concept that came out of my master's research, which is a relaxed masculinity, that most men in 12-step culture, they get a relaxed masculinity. They're not really aware of gender. They're not really aware. They don't see the water per se, but they're just a little more relaxed in the armor of masculinity, right? And then there's conscious masculinity. And conscious masculinity, obviously, is exactly what it sounds like. The key to all four of those is the role of shame and trauma. And there's incredible men who adhere to a more traditional masculinity, who many would dismiss or deride because of their values or what they do or blah, 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 that I think are incredibly wonderful men. They just have their eyes haven't necessarily been opened to what's possible, and they haven't had a lot of shame and trauma in their lives per se. And so they haven't gotten the they haven't been woken up. And it's not a good or bad thing, but it's like traditional masculinity, it kind of moves through. But that's only how things used to be. Like you said, today the conversation is growing so quickly, so rapidly, so profoundly that my greatest fear is the lack of intention behind it. That a lot of it is reactive. A lot of it is aimless. It's this kind of I just I as I watch it, I think part of my mission is to help steer the conversation around what it means to be a man in the 21st century with intentionality.
Oh, I love it. I know because I mean, look at if I just get out on the road and get into my car and just start driving, I'll end up somewhere. But it's a whole different thing if I put on my intentionality is like my GPS and I have something to go. Now I have to pay attention along the journey. I have to be very clear as I'm moving along from one place to another because there's so much to be valued, but I have that direction.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, to me, that's what it's about. It's haphazard right now. It's haphazard just in the same way that, like, for the work that I've been doing these last many years in the addiction and mental health field, I'll have guys who come up to me and they say, "Oh man, it's so awesome what you're doing. It validates some of my experience." Or I'll go visit a treatment program and they're like, "Oh, this is so great because we're doing what you're talking about." And almost inevitably, they're only doing some of what I'm talking about because they still don't see the water. They're immersed in a paradigm that says this is how men are, as opposed to let's step back and really move into an inquiry about who men are, right? And so move from a declarative statement into a more inquiry or an interrogative statement or
I
question.
love it.
But the interesting thing for me is that you don't know what you don't know,
No.
and you can't see what you're not looking at. And that's what I find so often is that because it's passive, because there's not a lot of intentionality to it, there's an incredible amount of confusion. If there's one word that defines men in our society today, I would fundamentally argue that it's confusion.
Absolutely, and I just so agree with you. It is confusion. I'm also seeing it with the confusion. I'm seeing women because I work with a lot of women in my communication coaching practice, and so I'm getting this. So they seem to be feeling it too. It seems to be, and I know this is so much fun to end the conversation here because this means perhaps I can bait you into another one.
I'm
Is
in it.
to
I'm in. I'm in.
is to say
I
this
love this.
is to say this is that I. Whenever it happened in human evolution, that awakening happened, that first consciousness when it happened, I feel like we're going through the another one. That
Without question.
humanity.
Without question. With I have absolutely no question. In fact, if you were a Christian, and this is something I thought of many, many years ago when I was in graduate school. I thought of, okay, so they always talked about 2,000 years approximately for, quote unquote, the Christ to return. And what exactly would that mean? And many, not just, not me. I mean, I've read this in many other people's writing, but it's that Christ consciousness is returning. And Christ consciousness has nothing to do with Christianity, has nothing to do with religion. It's about one's awareness of themselves and the world in which they're living. And so I couldn't agree with you more, Dennis. I mean, I spend some guys and spend their time watching soccer. I spend my time thinking about this stuff. I mean, it's not
Me
good or
too.
bad. It's not good or bad, but it's nice to have somebody else who does the same thing.
It is.
Because
It is.
because
Well,
I
let me
think
tell
we're
you.
a smaller percentage.
And growing. This is the. But it's like what the Maharishi. I remember the first time I heard about TM, and this is probably when the Beatles came out. Maybe it was a little bit before, but he was talking about what a small percentage of people it took for there to be a pop. For the shift to happen. And that's what I think is happening right now. It doesn't take that many of us. And that's why I think these conversations are so damned important that you and I are having now and that we're sharing.
And I think we're needing to kind of start winding down, so I'll leave us with one of these kind of parting thoughts. But I mean, what I would say is if you continue that metaphor of society as an addict,
Yes.
our society is in the process of hitting bottom. And as a collective, we are hitting bottom. What does that mean? Well, it means shit is all over the place. It
yes.
means on one day, it's we're like, oh, my God, peace on earth, goodwill to men. And on the other, it's like, let's kill everybody. And it's you could even take that analogy of the crucible of growth that you begin to become aware of in recovery. I see the same thing happening. If we were to anthropomorphize society, like, I totally agree. That's the consciousness. And you don't have a shift in consciousness like this, like we're experiencing, without incredible disruption. And so the analogy or the analogy I use a lot of the time is like, what is shifting today are the tectonic plates of consciousness. And we know what happens when tectonic plates rub up against each other, even the slightest bit.
Yep.
There is massive disruption, and yet out of that, the greatest things come. And so if you take a more Eastern view of all of this, through all of this destruction, through all of this chaos, is coming some of the most beautiful, amazing opportunities. And I guess I might have my moments of despair and I might have my moments of hopelessness and depression, but I am an inveterate optimist and I'm an inveterate humanist.
Yes.
And I believe that we are on a path toward improvement and actualization, and evolution is bringing us toward something so powerful. And I think that's part of why, to go full circle, why I had a bit of a reaction to your question without even asking for clarification, so I apologize for that. But your question about the testosterone and biology is because I believe human experience has been so limited by how people have interpreted our past and seen that as a biological determinant of our future. And if any group knows more than any other group that our past does not determine our future, it would be addicts. Because by virtue of our past, we should all be dead, in jail, or in an insane asylum, and yet here we are, not only contributing to the society, but even making a huge difference in many different ways. So I react strongly to the biological determinists and to the ones who say, well, this is how men have always been, and this is how women have always been, and this is how society has always been. And I'm like, I don't care.
I
don't care.
That's what I wanted to hear. That is what fun. Dan Griffin, God bless your heart. I'm having a ball. We're going to have, I look forward to talking with you offline, and we'll schedule another dialogue. And I have much to ask you, much to share, and to bounce back. But thank you for this initial conversation, and I look forward to the next opportunity of us having another conversation.
Dennis, you made my day. This was wonderful. This was
all right,
absolutely,
man.
Wonderful. Time flew, and I greatly appreciate it.
All right, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Great.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much.